Quit laughing.
I'm trying.
Welcome to Gola. I'm Katie Parla, a Rome-based food and beverage writer, culinary guide, and cookbook author.
And I'm Danielle Caligari, an assistant professor in Italian at Dartmouth College and a certified specialist of wine.
I'm back. Hi. Hi. Katie, what podcast is this?
Oh, you know, I shouldn't go off script. Well, welcome to Gola.
We are here to talk about Italian food, culture, history, and lots of other stuff too, as always, except that this week, Katie, we are talking about something that's sort of the opposite of indulging in food the way we usually do.
Correct. We're going to talk about Lent, but let's also touch on Carnival so we can talk about fried stuff.
We can't talk Lent without Carnival, if that's the only, or I should say we can't talk Lent without fried stuff, which is our rule in general. So that's always a safe way to start out warning people that although this will be about fasting, it is also about having fun. And as it turns out, the fasting part isn't that awful either, because no one will be surprised to learn that Italians over centuries of being asked to abstain to some extent have found a series of loopholes and a variety of methods for making food and fun, even while they were supposed to be reflecting upon how terrible they are and how likely it is that they are set going straight to hell.
Yeah. So. I mean, eternal damnation, always cool to ponder no matter what, especially over a meal. But before we dive into this actually quite delicious topic, we've got some new supporters.
We do. I can't believe we are just getting flooded with amazing people helping us out. And actually, in particular, right now, this is super important, as we mentioned, because Katie, you are in the midst of a world tour to support your Food of the Italian South cookbook release. And as a result of that, you will be coming to me sometime soon, and I will then be coming to you sometime soon after. We have the possibility of putting together some events, and so all of the support that is coming our way is not just propping up Gola, but giving us the potential to think outside the box and possibly do some fun things in situ. And we have no less than two new people who have thrown some cash our way to make sure that happens. One is our new friend, Guan Yang, who started supporting the podcast just this week. And another new friend, Michelle McPhee, also just this week signed up to give us something that shows how much they're loving our time here, Katie. And I am super grateful, just in time for Lent.
Yes. Thank you so much to both of you. And, you know, it's not just that I'm coming to you sometime soon. We've got dates. I'll be in Oakland on the 27th of March and San Francisco on the 28th of March. So look at our respective social media platforms for when we might be getting together and doing some cool Gola-themed event.
Yeah. And in the meantime, while we're still shuffling around and getting things together, make sure that you take advantage of Katie's other upcoming events that are very firmly scheduled and extremely structured in the way that Katie's events always are. Beautifully organized, deliciously catered, and super fun opportunities to also shake the hand of.
And I think there was a listener question about whether you can just bring copies of Food of the Italian South to events.
Yes, that's right.
If it's a dinner in which the book is included, yeah, sure. Bring the book that you pre-ordered because you're going to get another one. I can personalize it to your neighbor, your cousin, your parents, your kids, whatever. I've got a Sharpie. I know how to use it. But if the event is at a bookstore, just bear in mind that I collaborate with independent bookshops, and it's not okay to bring a book to a bookstore that hasn't been purchased there unless you also buy books at that bookstore. So yeah, I mean, like, maybe sneak it in a bag. That might be like a little bit problematic, but do know that places like Omnivore in San Francisco, now serving in Los Angeles, are independent bookshops, and they depend on your support. So, you know, especially if you purchase a book at an online retailer like Amazon, do be respectful of that shop and do make purchases at the indie. And now let's talk about Lent, man.
Yeah, absolutely. That is a great answer to a very good question that leads us right up into our discussion for this week. And Lent can't be spoken about until we talk about a little, or I should say, we can't really get into Lent until we at least explain what Lent is and what people are fasting for in the first place. Because while most of our listeners are probably hyper aware of the liturgical calendar and how it affects Italian lifestyle, if not dining practice, we also do have hopefully a few people who aren't quite so up to date on what's happening in Christian politics today. So, Katie, what is Lent actually right now, I think, is a great question. You're living in Rome. You wake up every day and decide what to eat and go outside and see what's in your local bar or cafe. And those things are, to some extent, still responding to the now multi-century, nearly multi-millennia history of Christianity in Italy, but not entirely anymore, right?
Oh, I mean, Italy, I think generally speaking, is a pretty secular place where people kind of like in a traditional sense interpret their Catholicism as they see fit. And I know a lot of, I think statistically, most people in Rome or Naples or whatever city you name would report that they are, in fact, Catholic. They don't necessarily follow all of the requirements of Catholicism as the Pope or their local priest might demand. But we can definitely understand why this is the case, because since 1870, the Pope hasn't been in control of Rome. But for hundreds of years before Italian unification, governments were either explicitly religious or they had some influence coming from the Pope in Rome that would dictate the behavior of kingdom residents.
That is a hugely important point to make, because while we tend to think of it as sort of a default mode of living or a choice, in fact, many of the pieces of dietary code that we're about to talk about were in fact enforced at a political governing level, right? So it's not just somebody deciding that they are of Catholic Christian faith or pre-Reformation, just Christian faith. They would have also been forced to some extent to follow certain practices as a result of the fact that entire cities, entire regions, entire swaths of the peninsula were following codes that were written for and by the church that coincided with legislation and law at a governing level, right?
So what would that have looked like? Because generally speaking, like in Roman, in like at least the Roman tradition, Lent lasts 40 or 40-ish days, depending on the calendar, beginning on Ash Wednesday, finishing on Holy Thursday, which might always be 40 days. No, it's 46 days.
So actually, it's funny that you're saying this, because this is something that was defined slowly over the early and the high Middle Ages. At first, the Lenten fast was, I think actually one of the first rules that was written was 36 days total. Then it was slowly moved towards 40. And the bookends that you're talking about, Ash Wednesday and Easter, obviously Sunday, were put into place firmly, and the 40-day length became firmer sometime in the later Middle Ages. And the idea of that fast was a gear up for Easter, which is the day on which Christians believe that the Jesus, who died 3 days earlier, rose again as Christ and made it clear that there was a path to salvation for all humans on earth. The preparation period for that was meant to be a lengthy fast. 40 days or less or more, in any case, was certainly one long stretch that reflected an ongoing cycle of fast at that point. So most Christians during the high into the late and Middle Ages and then beyond that would have observed fasts on Fridays all year on a series of other holy days. And then Lent would have been the sort of culmination that brought all of those fasting practices into one long stretch up to the moment of Easter. The real question, though, is what does it mean to fast, I guess, right? Because that part is a little trickier.
Yeah. So what is fasting? Because I'm not familiar with the act of it. Yeah. Like, I've heard of it and I've definitely read about it.
Yeah. I've also heard of abstaining from things, but I've yet to try it out myself. The idea of fasting is a slippery one, and we've talked about this a few different times in a few different places, because fasting is something that has to do with other dietary choices too, or limiting what one eats and how one eats it to be more reflective or to prepare the body for the reception of a greater spiritual or intellectual ideal. Is something that comes up in a variety of other contexts. But in terms of a Christian fast, traditionally this meant no meat, obviously, also mostly no dairy products. And in theory, although increasingly less in practice, no wine / alcohol, although wine was the alcohol of choice. So that basically eliminated what drinking anyone would have done.
What about the brothel sitch? Is that also a thing?
Oh, good question. Yeah. So sex is also something that you're supposed to be abstaining from. But again, you would be surprised at how people begin to slowly reinterpret these understandings of what a fast or what abstinence might mean, particularly when we get into the Lenten period of 40 long days and cold nights that usually coincide with this time of year. Because in fact, we are on a very late Easter calendar year. And Easter this year doesn't fall until the 20th of April, following, of course, the lunar calendar, since Easter is tied to the Jewish Passover and the Last Supper that was a Seder. But it is normally preceded by 40 days in the dead of winter, of course. So we are also imagining a time and a place in which people are not just abstaining, but also feeling the kinds of unfortunate effects of short days with very little sun, cold weather, damp, and the kinds of things that now we don't suffer from quite as much, but certainly in a pre-modern and early modern era would have made this time of year pretty depressing, frankly.
Yeah, I'm getting sad just thinking about it.
But Katie, cheer up, because as you know very well, Italians always come up with great solutions to great gastronomic solutions to such problems. And there was no lack of inventiveness during Lent and on fast days in general. And that has led us to a series of foods that are now associated with this period that, despite now not being necessary, either because of refrigeration and other preservation techniques that allow for a greater diversity of foods to be available now, or because people are simply not nearly as observant as they might once have been, we nonetheless still have a lot of lovely traditions that float up to us and that are.
Okay, so what are these foods?
So these foods are what you would expect more or less, although then they get a little weirder and more interesting when you dive in. So, you know, we said no meat, obviously. So what's going to replace meat? Well, the obvious answer is fish for most of the Italian peninsula. That's not too tricky, although there's a pretty significant portion that is landlocked and that would not have necessarily been able to enjoy at least fresh fish. And that leads to the heavy emphasis on one thing that all of us have probably eaten, especially if you come from an Italian-American tradition or have friends who have cooked in an Italian-American tradition for you. And that is cod, of course.
Oh, yeah. Bacalà, the ubiquitous salted fish from Northern Europe.
Exactly. So cod is the name of the game in Lent. It's all over the place. It's everywhere. And it shows up not just as bacalà in its salted form, but also as, I think it's the direct translation in English, stockfish. Is that right? Stoccafisco?
Yeah. Yeah. That's air dried, right? Instead of salted.
You got it. Yeah. So if bacalà doesn't get you hot and bothered, well, stockfish can be your alternative. And from there, of course, all of the little fish that you and I love so much, which can go under oil, which can be salted and dried themselves, which can be packed tightly and use their own oils and fats to preserve for longer than they might otherwise. And all of those nice umami flavors that come from those kinds of little fatty fishes were also used in sauces. And in fact, one of the dishes that you and I have already talked about is often associated with Lent as a result of that. And that's a pasta with a collatura sauce.
Ooh, delicious. Yeah, the very savory juice or liquid that comes from salting anchovies and letting them hang out. Exactly. In a barrel.
I know. So far, we are really on a roll with how delicious all of this is going to sound. But what about things that aren't just dried or salted fish? We have, of course, a handful of things that come from the attempt to recreate dairy that wouldn't have been allowed. And so a lot of Renaissance cookbooks, for example, tell us, or I should say, explain ways in which almond milk can be used to replace milk from other animals, and especially how to create things like mock cheeses or even more elaborate dishes that lead us right into the discussion of the number one Lenten loophole, which is sweets.
That's fascinating.
So, Katie, you live in Rome, so you know about one of the great all-time Lenten sweets. And I think that your experience with it is probably worth recounting here, because there are two sides of this coin, right?
Yeah, so the I would say Rome's most famous Lenten treat is the Maritozzo Quaresimale, which I guess roughly translates to the 40-day Maritozzo, or the Maritozzo of the 40-day fast. Yeah. Thanks. Working on that Italian over here. And, you know, the Maritozzo is this delicious yeasted bun that is sliced open and filled with an impossibly huge amount of whipped cream. Instead, the Lenten version uses oil or margarine in the sort of a brioche bun, and is made with the absence of whipped cream and the presence in the dough of pine nuts and candied fruits and raisins. And it's kind of like dense and caloric. A lot of places, instead of using oil, they'll use margarine. And generally speaking, places in more observant parts of Italy will advertise like a shift away from, you know, butter bases to margarine bases during Lent.
Yeah, exactly. Right. That's the main difference, is going to be the attempt, at least on the surface, to avoid clearly non-fast ready foods like butter. And Maritozzi, I love how clear the example becomes with this specific dessert, because nothing screams, we are technically fasting, but still not really willing to give anything up, like a Maritozzo, in which you replace a mountain of whipped cream with nuts and candies.
Yeah. I mean, it's probably the same exact number of calories in the long run.
Yeah. But of course, Maritozzi aren't the only desserts that you'll see popping up around Lent. It's a time that, again, despite the fast that is meant to characterize this period, suites are the place where we most often see a kind of shift in the availability of seasonal items, right? So you'll go down to your local pasticceria in Florence or Rome, in our cases, or elsewhere in Italy, and you'll see a kind of cambio di banco, like a whole of refreshing of what's available. That includes, for example, the maritozzi that are specific for Lent. In the case of Florence, the ubiquitous schiacciata alla Fiorentina, which, as Katie already knows, I am not particularly hot on. I think it's the most boring of desserts that Italy has invented. but I will no doubt get plenty of backlash for that. I actually prefer, on the scale of boring desserts, the schiacciata ranks low for me, whereas I like really hard, sad cookies much better than sweet, dunked in sweet wine, as I might have been able to get an indulgence for if I showed myself to be adequately weak and female to my local bishop. But Katie, speaking of sweets, we can sort of wrap up our discussion of Lenten foods by following sweets around in a circle back to where we are right now, which is in the moment just before Lent, otherwise known in Italy as Carnevale.
Yes, Carnevale is a time of deep fried, delicious dough things filled with eggy cream, so much dairy stuffed into a pastry shell. It's really super festive, and it used to be accompanied by full-on like parties. You know, pre-unification in Rome, Carnival was a big deal. Now I think a lot of listeners will recognize like the Venetian Carnival or maybe the Via Reggio Carnival. But you know, this was a time when people would party, and you know, local nobles and members of the church would host, I mean, binges, for lack of a better word, because you want to make sure everyone gets all the sugar and alcohol drinking and brothel frequenting and like pleasure doing out of their system before they have to reflect on their evil nature. But you know, those days are gone. Although Rome, like what, 5 or 10 years ago, tried to reinstate the carnival. The city of Rome tried to reinstate the carnival with zero success.
Oh, that's so funny. I don't think I realized that, I guess. I guess what better announcement of how little success they had than me not even noticing that it was attempted.
Yeah, it was really sad.
as you point out, there are two famous carnivals in Italy still today, Viareggio in Tuscany and of course Venice, even more famous and a magnet for tourists if ever Venice needed one for the couple of weeks a year in which the place isn't totally inundated. But those times of year are in some ways the last vestiges, or I should say those places that really still celebrate this time of year, are the last vestiges of, as you point out, a strong history that celebrated this moment across the peninsula, and in which especially there was a class inversion, so that people were not just indulging in terms of food with these incredibly calorie-packed and decadent desserts that were fried and stuffed with cream often, or dusted with sugar, or decorated sometimes with gold leaf and other things that would connote their excess. They also were experimenting with the unexpected in general. And this was frequently seen in the sex houses of that were already heavily frequented by the nobility of the time, but now would be also opened up and sort of let to spill out into the streets. And there would be these inverted banquets where the noble or elite class would serve the poor and would show for a moment that everything had gone totally crazy, just in time for everybody to button right back up and get back into their pious state for the 40 days of Lent.
That's such like a Saturnalia vibe. I love it.
It's, well, you know, Katie, because the farther you go south in Italy, the less people pretend that their Christianity isn't heavily influenced by pre-Christian elements. And food is a place where we see that carrying through. There's so many things that are about a cultural more that pre-exists faith practices and that faith practices bent to, as opposed to vice versa when you really look closely, right?
Definitely. I mean, I don't have any carnival treats very close to me. However, all this talk has gotten me pretty hungry.
Well, in America, there are still a few options. In fact, speaking of schiacciata alla Fiorentina, I think you were recently in New Orleans where have a very similar cake, right?
Oh, king cake. I love my king cake. It is so intense. Brioche, sugar laced. Mm-hmm. There's icing all over it. It's colorful. And in case there was any confusion about the Catholic nature of this cake, the little baby Jesus in a plastic, pink plastic form is inserted in the bottom of the cake. That way you can't tell where it's been placed. And then whoever gets a slice of the king cake with the baby Jesus in it has to buy the next one. It's a beautiful tradition, and I love it.
And so Carnevale has followed you on your path from Italy to America this year, and hopefully Lent will too, although not in its cruel and a true form of a prominent fast, but rather in its curated form in which you get to continue to indulge, although in things that you might not normally eat or think of, like dried fishes and almond milks.
Yes. I never want to think of those two things together.
Well, actually, a lot of people still soak their baklava in milk, I think, right?
Oh, yeah. Okay, true.
So never, you never know.
Touché.
You never know. We can get there. It's a long walk, but we can make it. Other than our last Lenten wishes, is there anything else you need to update Gola listeners on, Katie?
I mean, I think people are pretty sick of hearing about this, but Food of the Italian South is coming out March 12th. I would love it if you pre-ordered. It's available wherever books are sold. While Amazon is going to be the most convenient source, you can also pre-order it from your local indie. And if you want a signed copy, Omnivore Books in San Francisco is offering pre-ordered signed copies. So go on the website, you can order a book, and I'll sign it when I go to the bookstore, and then they'll ship it out to you. I can personalize a message. I think this is a really wonderful way. If you can't get to one of the events, all of which are listed on my site, katieparla.com/events, you can still get a signed copy. Food of the Italian South makes a wonderful gift. It's a way to travel virtually, gastronomically, and I hope that you'll consider it. And that is all.
I think that is a lovely idea. And while Easter gifts are perhaps somewhat less common, at least now, why not think of somebody who could use a little pick-me-up and maybe some much-needed information on the lost or soon-to-be-lost cultures and foods of the Italian South that Katie is desperately trying to make sure get to you before it's too late. And enjoy that special treat with the signed and even personalized copy. I can't imagine anything better to kick off your spring season of cooking and rejoicing, however you do it.
Thank you.
And with that, I think we will sign off letting people know that they can follow us on Instagram at Dr. Caligari's Cabinet, at Katie Parla, and look out for upcoming episodes of Gola.
Absolutely. And in the meantime, subscribe, share, and support.